Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The March for Science will be a nationwide march by scientists, researchers, and science advocates happening this Saturday. The big march is in Washington, D.C., where thousands are expected to turn out in support of science and what science, technology, and more contribute to humanity. Hundreds of thousands of other supporters are pledged to take part in more than 500 satellite marches across the country, including 21 marches in the state of Florida. But as the science-minded rally, questions are being raised about how political scientists should be or if they should march at all. Joining us to talk about the march and find some answers to those questions is Dr. Darren Rumbold with FGCU's Marine Science Program. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi.
Also joining us is geologist Joanne Mueller, who studies climate change in tropical environments here at FGCU. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also we have Dr. Edwin, also known as Wynn Everham, leader of the FGCU Environmental Studies Program, discussing Earth Day events in Southwest Florida. Welcome.
Thanks, Julie. Very happy to be here.
We are talking about the upcoming March for Science happening nationwide this Saturday. Will you be taking part, or do you have other plans for celebrating Earth Day? Give us a call and share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, Dr. Darren Rumbold, let me start with you. You've worked with the Union of Concerned Scientists and other groups. This may be an obvious first question, but what is science?
Oh, okay. Science is simply a systematic way to collect data and organize it in such a way to reveal patterns. And we do this to make the universe a little bit more predictable.
And when science is being performed, I suppose, or being investigated, it's usually a very critical analysis. Do you look at it from every single side to try to disprove every possibility?
Yes, we try to falsify it. We can never prove anything totally, definitively. But we can easily disprove something. So our job is to keep an open mind, be objective, and to look for any evidence that disproves a theory.
So what are the ideas and values that you and others are marching for that we collectively call science?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I also like the way you phrase it. It's not just about scientists. It's about anyone who sees the value in using science or evidence in making decisions. So, I mean, during the hurricane season, we would never make a decision about putting up the shutters or leaving town without first checking the latest news about where the hurricane tracks are pointed. And that's using science. No one would go boating without checking the weather and the tides. And if you're going to a medical doctor, you expect that individual to be basing your treatment on the best available science. We expect that of our policymakers as well.
I understand what you're saying. You're expecting policymakers to also check the facts before
Yes.
deciding on what to do. Okay. And Dr. Wynn Everham, those ideas that Darren just mentioned, they're high ideas that most people can get behind, at least on paper. As you see it, where do the problems arise when it comes to science meeting the real world?
Thanks, Julie. If I could just add to Darren's, I think for me a short piece is that science is the best tool that we have for separating truth from untruth. The universe is. It's not what we want it to be. It's not what we hope it to be. It is. And so if we start from the facts of what is, we can have different interpretations of what those facts might mean that will lead us to making the best decisions that we can. But if we can't start out with the same set of understanding reality, we're never going to get to the place where we make wise decisions about how to predict the future. So where does it fall apart? Sometimes I think it falls apart in science education K-12, where unfortunately we tend to teach science as only a body of facts and not a process for adding to those bodies. And so that some people get confused that whenever we're investigating the edge of our understanding, there'll be disagreements initially about what the facts are as we gather them, and then the pattern that Darren talked about emerges and how to interpret those facts. So real cutting-edge science is always, at least temporarily, controversial. And I think that because many people have experienced science as right, wrong, black, white, they see that cutting edge and they think it must be bad science. I think that's where it breaks down to begin with. I got another piece too, but go ahead.
But that's an interesting point because it looks at the person's psychology when approaching science. And they're approaching it from black and white. Yeah. And then when they see any misstep, and see, I wrote, I was going to ask later, but I'll get to it now. But, you know, people look at things like viral studies that just a few controversial little attention-getting statistics pop out, and they get a lot of traction. And then when further science discredits it or negates it, people look at it and become doubters. And then they become doubters of science as a whole.
Yeah.
And that's where you're seeing the problem.
Yeah, I think so. And then I think the other piece for me, and you know, you guys add to this, is we shouldn't ignore the fact that some of the things that scientists uncover about the universe are going to have economic impact on some people. And so when our facts are uncomfortable, the first response is for the people who are discomforted by them is to challenge the facts. That's just being human. So when people first unraveled the connection between smoking and cancer, there was a hard pushback from the smoking industry. The science is inconclusive. The science is incorrect. And it took a while for enough facts to accumulate for those people to be shown to be wrong. But that reaction to new understanding is almost always inevitable.
Also, all the way down to the bottom, the people that still want to continue to smoke can manage to deny the fact. Yeah. I have an aunt that does exactly that.
Yeah.
So, Gene Muller, you're a professor of marine science here at FGCU, and you study climate change and tropical environments. So climate change is a globally important issue, and yet there's a huge minority – well, not a huge – but there's a vocal minority who – they're very loud – say that it's not happening. People say that there are people who will say that there is no climate change. It's a hoax. For our listeners in Southwest Florida, what do you see in your research in our own backyard in the Gulf Coast that makes it a pressing issue for you and that you can point people to say this is evidence of it here?
Well, so my research in Southwest Florida mostly focuses on looking at past hurricane dynamics and landfalls. So we try to extend the instrumental record, so what we know of hurricanes, far back into the past in order to look at long-term cyclicity. And what we've seen here in Southwest Florida is we tend to see a lot more stronger landfalling hurricanes when sea surface temperatures are warmer out in the Atlantic Ocean. And this is something that they've also seen when they look at hurricanes, when they compare them with the instrumental records. This is something we know very well, that especially increased sea surface temperatures increase hurricane strength intensity. So we also see that in the geologic record, and this was obviously one of the predictions from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. As atmospheric temperatures rise and sea surface temperatures rise, we're going to be changing those hurricane dynamics, essentially cyclogenesis. So that's what our research has shown in Southwest Florida, but you know, we've also been looking at research that look at changes in precipitation, so drought and flood, and other factors like that, like sea level rise. We have scientists here at FGCU that also study that, and these are all things that we're seeing already taking place in Florida.
So, Joanne, then there are people who will argue on the other side of that and say, well, this is what the Earth just does. I mean, you know, we used to have ice ages, and now we're just in one of these cycles. I mean, so how do you respond to people that simply, you know, from the armchair quarterback, look at it and say, well, I saw Ice Age the movie, and it used to be very cold. Now it's just warm again. So how do you respond to that?
Right. Well, that's actually my research area. So I'm a paleoclimatologist. So I study natural climate variability. So I know very well what the cycles are. And you know, we do go through cold glacial periods, 90,000 years, a cold glacial period, and then into a 10,000-year stretch of an interglacial, this warm period that we're currently in. And we are at the 10,000-year mark, so at the end of that interglacial, and we're not cooling, we're warming. When you look at the greenhouse gases for the last five interglacials, so we can look at them through ice core records, we can measure the amount of CO2, in the ice cores, the CO2 declines at the end of all of the last interglacials. Our current interglacial, though, it's increasing. So when students ask me, oh, I thought we were supposed to go into an ice age, my answer is yes. I mean, we do go into these over very long periods of time. It's not like you just go into an ice age next year or 10 years from now. It takes a long time.
It's not in a 10-day forecast.
No, it's like a 90,000-year period to get into a full ice extent. But my response is, well, you know, greenhouse gases have been rising towards the end of this last interglacial that we're currently in. So we can't cool. We're warming the atmosphere instead of cooling.
We're supposed to be cooling.
Well, we're necessarily, as humans, we're not necessarily supposed to be impacting it at all, but we have. And the science is very, very clear on that. You can't make a model reconstruct the temperature changes that we've seen over the last 100 years without forcing it with CO2.
So historically, scientists have kind of been, you know, scientists, not politicians. So what do you think has forced the issue to where now scientists are taking to the streets to say, look, these are the facts that we have come up with? Who would like to take this?
Hey, before we answer that, could I add something to what Joe just said?
Sure.
So I'm thinking back of when Darren said, hurricane's coming. You listen to the facts about the hurricane's coming. So if you're sitting on your couch and you hear climate's changing and you say it's changed before, I'm not going to do anything about it. If you're sitting on your couch and you hear a hurricane's coming and you say, hurricanes have come before, I'm not going to do anything about it, that's pretty dumb. So whether things have happened before or not, you got to look at the facts. You got to read about what's about to happen. You have to respond to it. So I think the climate change that we're seeing right now can't be ignored any more than an oncoming hurricane would be.
Yeah.
I mean, but your question was about...
But my question is, you know, scientists have done the science, and here's the science. They present it to the world, and generally people accept what or had accepted what is held to be facts by people who are doctors in the field and who have studied it for years. So what do you think is pushing now people, doctors, to want to get on the street and say, listen, we're not making this up?
Well, I could tell my personal story. I'm a fairly young professor, and I used to get really frightened to give public talks about climate change and to advocate for it because I'm not one for confrontation. I'm a scientist. I'm used to, like, working hard in my lab. I remember a colleague once saying to me, well, you know, if you're not advocating for it, if you're not speaking up and, like, and giving the science to the general public, then you're almost taking the other side. And so after that time period, I just started saying yes to every public talk I was asked to give, and I've had some pretty confrontational times. But it is really important, and this is something that is affecting people already. It's going to affect us in the future. The science, there's consensus. You know, between 97% to 98% of scientists, we're all in consensus over this subject. I don't think there are very few examples of that. You put a group of scientists in a room and talk, give them any experiment, we'll argue for hours. Mm-hmm. So having consensus on something in science is rare.
That's rare anyway.
Yeah. So the data, you can't argue with it.
I think scientists are generally pretty much skeptics anyway. They want to come in and prove everything.
Yeah, yeah. Extremely skeptical, especially Dr. Everham.
Oh, I was about to say, I disagree with that.
I disagree with that.
I think probably the issue of our time is the impact we're having on our atmosphere and then therefore the climate. But we can focus much more tightly. You know, a year ago, we were all concerned about harmful algal blooms and the results of releasing water from Lake Okeechobee. And so we have to figure out how to fix that.
Well, we have no attention span. That happened last year.
Yeah, so. Yeah. People forgot. So, but at the time, and, you know, Darren, if you saw other things than I did, we know that the decisions about how to manage water coming out of Lake Okeechobee are going to, whatever we do is going to make some people happy, some people unhappy, and cost people money. And so as soon as any of our science impacts that part of who we are, society, politics, economics, it gets controversial. And people who don't like what the science is telling them want to ignore it. And one of the ways that they can feel comfortable ignoring is to try to discredit it. I think so maybe the reason it's so much more today is because the science that we're doing is really, really important.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And the issue in my mind is that scientists are trained to be honest brokers of science. We're not supposed to come off as being an advocate for policy. We want to demonstrate that we're being objective, and we can see all those
and
other
sides.
And skeptical.
Yeah.
That's part of being a good scientist. And if we're supposed to be honest brokers of science, policymakers should be honest in what they're doing. Everyone recognizes that there are competing factors that they have to – they have the hard job. They have to look at all those different factors and make their decision. One of those factors should be the science. They should be honest when they make that decision as to what criteria was the deciding point. And if it's not science this time, that's fine. But there's no reason why you have to denigrate the scientist or defund the science. We recognize there are going to be other – you know, economics are going to have to come into play. But now the easiest thing for them to do is just either defund the science or denigrate the scientist.
We are talking about the upcoming March for Science that's happening nationwide this Saturday. Will you be taking part, or do you have other plans for celebrating Earth Day? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So the website for the Science March argues that the application of science to policy is not a partisan issue. And it says that when it comes to anti-science agendas and policies, there are guilty politicians on both sides of the aisle. So what are some of the anti-science agendas and policies that you think are important to push back against? And I want to throw that question to you, Dr. Rumble.
Again, I think the biggest problem is defunding the science. As I said, even if the science is before you and you don't necessarily think that is the priority, that maybe economics at this point in time would be the priority, it's no reason to denigrate that science or to try to defund it. We need to have an informed decision.
And if I can add to that, I think that some of what we're going to see in the media as the science marches take place all over the country is this pushback that says us scientists are only out there because we're interested in not having our jobs cut. My job's not going to be cut. I'm going to be here still doing the job. But I'm not interested in saving my job. I'm interested in saving the planet, which probably sounds silly, but it's the truth.
Do scientists feel that there are any even jobs at risk currently?
Oh, I think that there's some people that are concerned about positions in the federal government as we try to downsize the government are going to be impacted. That's accurate,
well,
isn't it?
Yeah, beyond absolutely. That, is they're going to deregulate and they're going to make it easier for the regulated community to push their agenda forward. And so even the consulting firms that do, you know, contract work to evaluate environmental impact aren't going to get the same level of funding. So there's a lot of people that are going to be impacted. But I agree. I don't want anyone to mistake this March on Saturday is just scientists worried about their jobs. There's going to be a lot of people out there that are not even scientists.
Yeah, I can see that maybe somebody might lob that complaint.
Yeah.
But that would be...
I'm not worried about my job. I'm worried about making wise decisions as we go into the future, and I feel like part of my job is to inform that decision-making. And I feel like that's true. I think most scientists feel that way.
Right.
Is there any important science work that's not being done today because of politics that you know of?
Well, that's a great question. I wish I the answer is I bet a lot.
and economic interest. Is there any privatization of science studies? I mean, does scientific research tend to come as a result of federal or state funding?
I'll
is there anything, anybody private doing?
Yeah, I'll add to this and then Darren will correct me if I get any of it wrong. I don't do a lot of science in terms of toxicology and the impact of adding pollutants into the environment, but some of my work touches on that. And I have this sense that an awful lot of the regulations that we have about controlling particular potentially toxic compounds is done by the companies that are producing the potential toxic compounds, not enough that's done outside of that economic interest, and almost none that I know of where people are considering multiple compounds at the same time. And so I think there's some things that are understudied in the environment, and I think, I'll leave it at that.
So, I mean, do you think that maybe, I'm just curious, with private scientific studies that are funded by companies, because it's private money, may not have the critical analysis that a government agency might have?
Not necessarily, but you want to be transparent on who gave you the money.
Okay.
For example, surprisingly, maybe to some people, Scotts Miracle-Gro is actually funding quite a bit of research now on nutrient impacts. They just did some over Indian River Lagoon. They're also contributed a very large sum of money to a prize that the Everglades Foundation, a $10 million prize that the Everglades Foundation has come up with to try to spur some more scientific investigation, maybe outside of of government. So, yeah, the non-governmental organizations are coming in and helping to fund the science. But the important thing is that you are transparent about who funds you so that people can, you know, again, make a critical evaluation as to whether they fully are, you know, how comfortable they are with the data and the design that you produced.
So since this march, as you've mentioned, is nonpartisan, is it possible to motivate people politically without being partisan? Do you find that to be a challenge?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jill.
I think it's definitely a challenge in the context of climate change. For me, it is relatively easy to stand up in front of a room and talk about the science and show the data without necessarily putting an opinion on it and allowing people to make their own decision by showing them the very best data and essentially what the trends in the data are and what the predictions are. And I think this is obviously a far better way for people to see science, to make decisions themselves. And so it gets a little – there's you know, a fine line there that you kind of have to tread. It has become kind of a passionate conversation that I have now with my students and with the general public, because this is something I've done for, you know, 15 years of my life. I've researched this very type of science, and to have it, the consensus on it, discredited, and the work that I've done and worked so hard towards discredited. I mean, it does become personal to a certain degree. So it is a little tricky sometimes, and I do find myself trying to tread, you know, a thin line, knowing that, you know, the best way to present the data is not by just presenting my opinions and telling people you should believe this.
But is it hard to hear people come at you with arguments?
Absolutely.
Sometimes?
Especially when they're basing them off of science that is not true, skeptical comments on the science. You know, things like, oh, well, I've been told it's all about methane and it's all methane. It's like, no, actually.
It's intensive farming that's causing everything.
Yeah, exactly. You know, all those skeptical arguments that I'm so used to hearing over and over again, you know, they have become less frustrating over the years as I've gotten used to them. But, yeah, it's I find myself saying over and over again, well, no, that is not true. That's not what the data says.
It seems like science is kind of heading out into popular culture in a place that it usually hasn't been either. I mean, people are there are TV shows talking about science and young scientists, and there are headliners at the march in Washington, including Mona Hanna Atisha, the doctor who was behind the exposure of lead poisoning in the water supply at Flint, Michigan; Lydia Villa-Kamarov, who's the molecular biologist who was part of the team that created a technique for synthesizing insulin from bacteria; and a science popularizer, Bill Nye, the science guy. He's a former Boeing engineer and head of the Planetary Society. Do you think headliners like this and this conversation being had by so many people, and then also having science been attacked and then having so many people rise to defend it, do you find that, you know, that is going to be important for the future of science and with young people?
Yeah, I would agree with that statement. And the problem is that scientists, as Joe was talking about, scientists want to show you their data. They're proud of their data. And sometimes they can start to bore you a little bit because they're so proud of their data. And we do need people that are ready to stand out and popularize it. And a lot of us scientists would rather stay in the lab or get in the field and not get in front of a couple of hundred people.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you feel about being out in the public and talking so much about science, defending it, and then having people rally around?
I was thinking about what Joe said earlier about this idea of science. Scientists are either bringing their science to a larger audience or they're effectively saying my science isn't important to that larger audience. So I thought about that a lot in the last decade, and I'm trying to do as much as I can. And I'm also thinking about your question about engaging in the political process. I think in our science methods courses, we engage a discussion about whether scientists, particularly scientists who are publicly funded, have an ethical obligation to communicate the results of their work to a larger audience. And I think we try to teach that. And then on top of that, I guess I can take criticism of people. I live in a country that is committed to a democratic process. So where it's appropriate in the content of my course, I'll encourage my students to vote. I'll never tell them who to vote for. or what to vote for, but I'll tell them, you're either in the game or you're not. You're either participating in the process or you're not. And the more the people participate, the better the process is. So I'm comfortable with those two things. Scientists should be out there, and everyone should be involved in the political process.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
And so when we look at these satellite marches, there are more than 20 of them happening in the state of Florida this coming Saturday, including the Naples-Fort Myers area, Sarasota, Miami, and Fort Lauderdale. What do you think people can expect at these marches?
I think they should expect for them to be peaceful.
Hopefully.
That would be great.
I mean,
it might be boring. Like, we might hold up graphs of our data.
Yeah, right? Hold up the periodic table. Yeah. See if anybody knows what that is anymore.
Yes.
So, and aside from the marches, can you guys supply, what would you think would be a way that people can support science on Earth Day if they're not big fans of crowds? Are there events going on around, or ways
to get
involved?
There's a lot of events. You know, a lot of organizations are celebrating Earth Day as just a celebration of the planet we all share. I'm not sure how many of them have really adjusted their agenda to focus on the idea of science being important. I think a lot of the other things happening on the 22nd is caring for the Earth is important. I see where the two are connected, but they're different.
Generally, people participating in science. I mean, if their kids are in school, encouraging them to work on their science and do their science projects. And I mean, every year I judge the regional science fair with Dr. Everham, and I look at all these young little scientists and how excited they are about their experiments that they did. I think all of those things, if they're not able to make it to a march, those types of things are sort of, they're advocating for science right there.
You know, I'll add this to it, Julie. Sorry, did you have something?
No, go ahead.
I'm doing a program the following weekend for the Crewe Land Trust about citizen science. So there's a lot of opportunities in Southwest Florida for people who are looking to volunteer some of their time to be involved with nonprofit organizations or agencies in the collection of information about water quality and the collection of information about trends in particular species in our region. And we all do this because we think it's fun.
And the theme for this Earth Day is environmental and climate literacy. So if nothing else, you could spend the day thinking about environmental and climate literacy.
Yeah.
Well, we have to wrap things up, but I want to thank you guys all for coming in. It's been really fun and interesting learning about what's inspiring people, scientists, to hit the streets. We're going to leave it there. Thank you to our guests, Dr. Darren Rumbold, Dr. Wynne Everham, and Dr. Joanne Mueller. Good luck with the marches this weekend, and have a great Earth Day. Show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our studio director is Richard Chin Kui, and our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Engineering support today thanks to Mike Stepp and Brad Taylor. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1 WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM NPR for Southwest Florida.